Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Everybody, I'm Amy Scott. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kai Rosdahl. It is Tuesday as we tape this. It is time for our weekly deep dive into a single topic today, refugee resettlement, the economics thereof in the United States. There is, of course, a long history of resettling people here who have been fleeing war and persecution. Started for real, sort of after the Second World War, and then after Vietnam, officially the government decided it was going to do something about it in the Refugee Resettlement Act of 1980, I guess. And we're going to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Since then, the U.S. has resettled hundreds of thousands of refugees across the country. The Biden administration has said it's going to welcome 100,000 refugees of the war in Ukraine, and is talking about a new program to expedite that process.
So the question for us today is, what happens to an economy when refugees become part of it? And here to make us smart is Rumya Vijaya. She's a professor of economics at Stockton University. Professor, thanks for coming on the pod.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm gonna lead with the big picture question, and then we can sort of tear it apart. What, generally speaking, does happen when refugees come into an economy?
So just at the outset, I just want to emphasize that, of course, refugee resettlement is a humanitarian imperative. But of course, refugees also bring with them tremendous economic potential, as well as economic aspirations, just like everyone else. And that needs to be recognized. So when refugees arrive in the U.S. Economy, the U.S. model of refugee resettlement assigns them to contract agencies that are called resettlement agencies. So they're typically given an initial allowance of about $2,000. It differs by state. And that is meant for their initial phase when they enter into the country, getting them a place to stay, setting them up with the very basic household products and goods to start their lives. The resettlement agencies, of course, augment this with some private donations. So you might have known in your community where you can donate for refugee resettlement. So these resources are extra. But the main focus of the U.S. refugee resettlement program is to just get them self-sufficient as soon as possible. So they have a
Jump in here real quick, Professor? $2,000, I mean, in this economy, it just doesn't seem like very much. And you said it's often supplemented. But I mean, is that enough to really get a foothold here?
Absolutely. So you absolutely pointed out the right problem here is that the refugee resettlement, contrary to what people think, actually offers very, very limited resources to the refugees themselves. So $2,000 doesn't go very far at all. If you think about even just making a deposit on a rental place, right? Typically, a lot of these refugee resettlement areas are also urban areas. So it is really a bare minimum start, which is why a lot of the resettlement agencies ask for private contributions. Now, those are not very dependable, neither are they substantial, because it really depends on getting the word out and getting the community involved. And of course, refugees are coming in staggered time. So the support that is really can be counted on is just the $2,000. And more, and even beyond that, they just get 3 months of support by the refugee resettlement agencies. After that, they're pretty much on their own. So they have to learn the system. They have to learn the life, the community, as well as find jobs within the 3 month period. So that is the aim.
How well does it work? That's fundamentally the question, right? You get $2,000 and then you get some help from private agencies. What's our success rate, I guess, if you will?
So in the 3 months, there is a rigorous program to train them, to give them the basic information. So some of the refugee resettlement agencies that I have been in touch with in Philadelphia, for example, they indicate that they have about an 80% success rate. That is, they're able to match refugees with some very basic job, make them self-sufficient, at least enough to pay for their accommodation and the basic survival. So the success rate seems to be fairly high.
Right. I imagine the skill level really varies. What kinds of training and job placement do they have? And do they tend to be matched with jobs that, you know, match their skill level?
That's a very important question. Of course, the skill level varies greatly. One thing to keep in mind here is that even if refugees are coming in at a high level of skills, let's say that they are college-educated refugees, had professional jobs, but some of those qualifications don't necessarily transfer over here. So that is a big roadblock often refugees encounter. So many of them start out with fairly low-skill jobs that they're able to find and they're matched with by the resettlement agencies. So the training that they receive is basic introductory level, but it really depends on where the refugees are coming from and what skill levels they're bringing with them. It's also important to note that the refugee resettlement program is very intensive. Just to be selected for resettlement in the US is a very intense, time-intensive process. Often refugees spend close to 10 or more years in a refugee camp before arriving here. So during that period of time, they have lost some of their job skills or the continuity with employment. So that, again, makes it hard in the initial years to perhaps match up with the skill levels that they might bring.
And then, of course, what happens is the economic gain that refugees bring, right? Because this is fundamentally a labor force problem, right? Immigration is a labor force issue. The economic benefits that you get from increased population working take time, right? And there's a drag, and that becomes then the political issue, right? That short term, oh my God, they're a cost to the society. And then you wait 5 years and they've got good productive jobs.
That's, of course, also, I would say, a perception problem. Because as we just discussed, they're actually not taking a whole lot. It's an initial resettlement allowance that is very, very small. Those who do not match with the jobs in the 3 months are allowed a very small amount called refugee cash allowance for the next 8 months. That varies by state. That's a little less than $300. So really, they're not taking a lot at all from the economic system. And a lot of research has shown that their period of time is very short by which time they sort of make up their labor force lag. So in my own research in Philadelphia, I found that within about 7 years, they are outpacing a comparable local median income levels or even labor force participation rates. Nationally, several research, including my own, has shown that within about 6 to 7 year time period, they're really able to catch up in terms of their labor force engagement. So they're out there. In fact, the labor force engagement participation of rates of refugees in many research has shown to be over 60%. On an average for the U.S. economy, labor force participation rates are a little less than 60%. So refugees themselves are doing all they can to integrate into the economic system. One other thing that I would note here is that a lot of them are working in what we now understand to be sort of frontline essential jobs. A lot of the jobs are in either caregiving, so home health care, personal aid. And the other big area where refugees tend to be matched is the meat packing and processing, all of which, you know, we've heard in the last few years are so critical to keep our economy going. And as for the perception problem, I also want to add that if we think about the refugee numbers over the years, then they are really a tiny amount of the total number of the labor force in the U.S., right? You think of a labor force of around 160 million. The refugee population each year is close to that resettled is only about 20,000. So the numbers just don't make sense for us to say that they're a drag on the labor force.
And generally, the research has shown that they are giving a lot more to the economy than taking, right? their contribution is much larger?
Yeah, that's a complex question. But yes, if they're already in the labor force and performing critical jobs, that is certainly a contribution. Besides that, of course, they are here. So they're bringing their own demand. They're buying products in the economic system. So they have shown that in a lot of the small declining industrial towns, they've really reversed that population loss and really revived downtown communities. For example, there are well-known stories about Buffalo or Utica, New York, even in the Southeast Corridor in Philadelphia, where they've really revived foot traffic and neighborhoods. So have being here and not only working, but also contributing to the economic ecosystem is only a positive economic contribution.
So let's get to practicalities.
And I'm thinking
here.
Of Erie, Pennsylvania, Erie, too, right, Kai,
right,
where you
absolutely.
And I have both done some reporting.
We've both worked in Erie, Pennsylvania, and that economy, as we've talked about on Marketplace, is hugely dependent upon the refugee and immigrant population. But look, Professor, let me ask you this,
just
to get down to brass tacks, right? We have 70,000, give or take, Afghan refugees that are in the resettlement process. The president, as Amy mentioned, has promised to take 100,000 Ukrainians. We are a labor force of 160 million people. Is that a lot? 170 million people coming into this economy?
That's just basic numbers. That's a very tiny amount, right? If there are 170,000, you also have to remember that the entry will be staggered.
Mm-hmm.
Although the president has said he will be taking in 100,000 Ukrainians, and they have said that they will find a way to accelerate the program. As I mentioned, that has not happened in the past. Even though the numbers are declared today, refugees take the vetting process for refugees take a long time. So we may not see this entire amount arrive at the same time. They'll probably arrive over the next decade or so. That is the reality of refugee resettlement. But even otherwise, the numbers are really a tiny fraction of the full labor force. And they will go to, as I said, different communities in the US. They're not all being put into the same community. So the effective impact is really, really very tiny. And the US labor market has much more dynamic impacts than this these refugee numbers, which are really, really a small amount here.
Let's talk about a different market, though, which is housing. I mean, we're in a huge national housing shortage. And here in the Baltimore area, I know that's been a real challenge in resettling the Afghan evacuees who've been coming here since the summer, late summer, just finding a permanent place for folks to live. And I'm wondering if we can absorb this additional population in that sense.
Yes, truly. Housing is a big issue. It's the same story here in Philadelphia, where just the stock of affordable housing in the city is very limited. But again, as I said about the diverse impacts on the U.S. labor market over the past 20, 30 years, that is the same thing for the housing infrastructure. It is not just a problem for refugees, neither is it a problem created by the refugees. Right? It is, we do have a housing shortage, particularly supply of affordable housing. And that has a lot to do with the fact that there is a tremendous amount of inequality in the US labor market, where a lot of housing has catered to the very wealthy. That sort of tracks the growing divide between the income of the high-skill and low-skill population in the U.S. So these are various supply and demand impacts that have preceded the refugee crisis and is certainly not going to be solved or exacerbated by this particular refugee numbers that we are seeing right now.
So just as a way to wrap this up, do you think that our refugee intake system has the capacity? Forget the economy, right? The economy could do it. We know that. Can our infrastructure, our refugee resettlement infrastructure, do it?
That is an excellent question. As I said, just the processing infrastructure is lagging just in terms of having the number of people to vet these refugees. So that certainly requires some amount of help. Right now, there are 9 resettlement agencies that are generally contracted by the U.S. Department of State. And these agencies then work with local teams and local subcontracting agencies as well. A lot of them are faith-based organizations. So they all could certainly use a lot of support, a lot of local support. So if people are listening in, that is what I would encourage them to do to make up for the lack of state resources. But overall, the program does need a lot more help in the processing to ensure that we do get the resettlement process up and running as quickly as possible. And that certainly helps in the economic integration mm-hmm. because we're talking about people with economic aspirations and potential. And the sooner we can get them resettled, the sooner they can integrate into the labor market.
Real quick before we let you go, though, I mean, the part of this is that the system is still recovering from cutbacks during the Trump administration, right, when the number of refugees was dramatically reduced. And they're trying to staff up and you know, get their resources in order to process the refugees that were going to be accepted even before the war in Ukraine.
Yes, absolutely. As some of you may be aware, for the first time since the 80s, when the program was formally began, the refugee intake numbers were reduced to 18,000, which is the lowest it has been in 40 years. So then the resettlement agency certainly did not then have the capacity or the funding to keep their staff on during those years. And now that we are suddenly facing this humanitarian imperative again, certainly the start up to restaff and reestablish those connections has been certainly an issue. And hopefully, mm-hmm. In the next year or so, that at least can move forward in a smooth manner.
All right. Ramya Vijaya is a professor of economics at Stockton University. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Great talking to you.
Good topic. Important topic.
Yeah.
All right. So if you've got thoughts about that conversation or refugee resettlement writ large or actually anything else you hear on this podcast, you know how to get us. 508-827-6278, 508-UB-SMART. You can send us a voice memo if you like, makemesmart@marketplace.org. We'll be right back.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, let's do some news. Amy Scott, you go first.
All right, I got some news. Okay. Well, the Wall Street Journal has some news that I'm going to tell you. So the Journal is reporting that Blackstone, the big investment firm, is making a huge bet on college student housing. And I think this is interesting because a couple of years ago at the beginning of the pandemic, college student housing was not a great business to be in when everyone was getting sent home and, learning remotely in their bedrooms. Their childhood bedrooms, I should say.
Oh, yeah. You kidding me? My second son spent his entire freaking sophomore year of college in the bedroom he grew up in. And let me tell you, he was a little cranky about it.
Still charging you for the dorm? I'm curious.
Good question. Well, he's at UCLA, right? So he was off campus at an apartment, which we were still paying rent on.
Yeah.
But yeah, the whole college housing thing is topsy-turvy right now.
Yeah. So anyway, Blackstone is buying this real estate investment trust called American Campus Communities, in a deal worth almost $13 billion. A lot of that is debt, because that's how these things work. But this is the largest publicly traded developer of student housing. It's based in Austin. And, you know, what surprised me is that, of course, at the beginning of the pandemic, as we discussed, when, everyone went home, campuses were closed and switched to remote learning, the company saw its stock tank. I mean, if you look at a chart, it's pretty staggering. But it's really come back. And what's striking is that these companies have fared a lot better than expected. Even during that period, according to the Journal, they were still collecting a lot of rent, which I think is a whole different story. Now, of course, students are back. Colleges are expecting and hoping that international student enrollment, which really tanked, will recover, which increases demand. There hasn't been a lot of construction in the past couple of years, so there's a real shortage of housing. You know, we talked about that before. Same old story there with student housing and off-campus housing. That pushes up rents so they can charge more. And Blackstone's head of real estate told the Journal that this is a really good bet because student housing isn't as vulnerable to economic downturns as other sectors. And in fact, I mean, in a typical downturn, COVID was pretty different, but in a typical downturn, people actually go to college. Yeah. So, and it's a good hedge against inflation because you can just raise the dorm rates every year. Yep. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how this market kind of bounces back and if more investors are going to pour money into this.
They will.
Yeah.
They will.
Okay. Wherever they make money.
That's right. That's exactly right. mine is, it's a story you kind of have to read, and we're going to put it on the show page. It's in the Washington Post today by their technology reporter, Taylor Lorenz. And it's a story about how internet conspiracy theorists, right-wingers, and I'm going to use this word intentionally, crackpots, get funneled directly into the right-wing media machine. It's a story about the woman who runs a Twitter feed, actually, now. Used to be TikTok, but she got banned. It's called Libs of TikTok. LibsofTiktok. Libs of TikTok. Look it up. And it's a crazy, crazy story about how this stuff is just getting mainlined into the neural networks of millions and millions and millions and millions of Americans and being amplified by Fox News and Joe Rogan and all the rest. And it's stunning and depressing, and you got to read it. Libs of TikTok by Taylor Lorenz today in the Washington Post. All y'all read it and report back. Send us your thoughts because it's wild. Wild, wild, wild. And I guess I shouldn't be surprised.
I'm actually biting my fist right now, so I don't say anything.
I guess I shouldn't be surprised. But anyway. Yeah, it's easy on this podcast. Nobody's listening, right? So you can say anything you want on this podcast. No, I'm just kidding. anyway, that's the news. Let us move on, shall we?
Let's do the mailbag.
Before I get into some trouble.
Hi, Kai and Kimberly.
This is Godfrey from San Francisco.
Jesse from Charleston, South Carolina.
And I have a follow-up question.
It has me thinking and feeling a lot of things.
Okay, so when I was out on spring break, which was 2 weeks ago, not when I had COVID, which was a week ago. I was crazy. It's been a crazy 2 weeks. Anyway, you brought some housing stories because that's what you cover for us.
That's what I do, yes.
And lots of people had some thoughts. Here's Anne in Colorado.
In my job working in the background on mortgage files, I'm seeing many, many, many homes selling above appraised value. Also, the homes are selling so fast that sellers can't find a new home prior to the closing date on the home they're selling. So they continue to live in the house after they sell it for 30 or 60 days. It's a weird market. Love the show. Just wanted to give my 2 cents from the mortgage industry.
Always welcome.
Thanks, Anne. And here's a voice memo from another listener who wants us all to stop saying sorry.
Really?
Hi, this is Dale calling from my backyard in North Carolina. Lots of podcasts these days are from informal locations. Often the person recording the podcast stops and begins profusely apologizing for pet, child, street, and other kinds of unintentional noise. Why is this such a big deal needing major apologizing? It's a normal part of life. A simple acknowledgement is more than enough. I really prefer the way you guys include this background. It makes listening more enjoyable. Take care and keep up the good work, guys.
Is that a rooster?
He did that on purpose, man. He got up at dawn just to record that freaking thing as the birds were going. Holy cow.
I don't think I've apologized,
No, I do sometimes.
Point taken.
I do sometimes about the dogs and the kids and whatever. All right.
My cats right now are racing around outside the closet, but I don't think you can hear it.
Can't hear a thing. All right. Before we go, this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question, what is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? Here we go.
This is Scott in Baltimore. One thing I thought I knew but was wrong about was how politics is required for almost any beneficial change in our society. I chose to pursue a career in science, thinking that technology was the rate limiting step to addressing many of the big problems we face, And it is important, but convincing the people in power to make decisions that benefit us, especially in the long term, is absolutely essential.
Yep.
Realizing this earlier in life would probably have influenced my career choices. Thanks. Okay. Love the show.
That's totally interesting. I'm going to say stick with what your passion is and do the science and technology thing because you like it. And somebody else can deal with the politics because they like it. That's what I'm saying. Anyway.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
I like that.
Yeah, totally.
Sad but true, though.
Yep.
Scott in Baltimore. Yep. Woo!
Go Baltimore.
All right. Keep sending us your answers and questions via voice memo to our email at makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you could leave us a message at 508-827-6278, also conveniently known as 508-UB-SMART.
All right, let's see. Super quick before we go, we're going to see if I mess up the credits music here. I'm out the rest of the week because my mom's in town, and the rule in my house is that I'm not allowed to go to work when my mother is in town. So, you know, domestic politics, trump all. Number two, Kimberly's out for like another 10 days, so we've got a revolving cast. Amy's here for a while. I think there's mother sitting in. And so it's going to be a little jumbled, but we'll get you through it. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Our team also includes producer Marquette Green and Ellen Rolfes. She writes our newsletters. Our intern is Tiffany Bowie.
I'm going to do my best, y'all. Today's program was engineered by Juan Carlos Torrado with mixing by Minxin Quingon, Ben Holliday, and Daniel Ramirez. Composed our theme music. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner. Donna Tam is the director of On Demand. Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough.
Nobody told you the rule that when the music stops, the credit stops? Sorry. If you're on the tail end of the credits, if you're on the tail end of the credits and the music stops, I'm sorry, you're out of luck. That's just the rule.
This is not a broadcast show.
What's going on? Gotta have rules. Gotta have rules. All right.
But yeah, there's very little training for this fill-in gig. You should probably know.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.